You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 7th of November, 2018. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS.
Live from Adori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, the President resumes his battle with the media.
Mr. President, that's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have...
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Donald Trump's apparently learned a lesson from the midterms. The lesson he's learned, apparently, is that people really like him. This may not have been what the people meant to say. We'll wrap up reaction from the results, starting with the sudden firing of Jeff Sessions. Elsewhere, a man who came close to being a left-wing prime minister in Australia has now signed up for the country's hard right. We'll find out why. And we'll ask why Australia, the US and the UK are all so nervous about allowing Chinese tech giants anywhere near next-generation mobile communications. Plus, while fashion's always drawing inspiration from the past, we'll ask why one designer is just reissuing his old clothes. All to come in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Hello, welcome to today's Monocle Daily. Now, usually after setbacks in midterm elections, a president speaks with humility about the lessons learned, the need to reach out to people, to heal divides. It will come as no surprise to you to hear that is not how Donald Trump has reacted to losing control of the House of Representatives. Instead, he said that yesterday's elections were very close to a complete victory, then threatened Democrats with a warlike footing from the White House. Then, a few hours after a rather fractious news conference, he fired his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, something he's been threatening to do for more than a year. Well, that raises all kinds of questions, which we'll explore now with Monocle's America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker. Ed, given the number of times that Donald Trump has threatened to fire Sessions, it's not that surprising that he's actually finally done it.
Maybe not, no. But I guess the timing is interesting that it came so soon after these midterms, literally the following day, and Jeff Sessions is out the door. There's no real hanging around, no real trying to paint it any other way than it is. You know, there was a feeling, it seemed, from those in Trump's inner circle that you couldn't fire Jeff Sessions before the midterm elections. It could be badly construed. It could affect some of those nail-biter races. And so despite the fact that there'd been, at the very least, a low grumble of discontent, and quite often much more than that, about Jeff Sessions, with Donald Trump increasingly attacking his Attorney General when giving mostly, you know, in media interviews, saying that he was weak at times, taking to Twitter to disparage him, and also saying that he should never have recused himself from the Russia investigation. And if he'd known that, he would never have hired him. So I think Donald Trump for a long time has viewed that decision that Jeff Sessions made as almost like an act of disloyalty. We know how the president sort of rewards those in his inner circle based on that sort of loyalty. And he felt that Jeff Sessions had taken a step out of line. And so, yes, as you mentioned, this really is the culmination of what has become perhaps just another of these many relationships that Donald Trump seems to have that end up souring. I guess the real question now is, what does that mean for the president? What does it mean for the the Mueller investigation being led by the DOJ? What does that mean for who will replace Jeff Sessions? Matthew Whitaker, Sessions' former chief of staff, is currently the interim attorney general, and he's kind of in many ways much more in line with Trump. Some have asked whether he might recuse himself, but others have said that's much more unlikely. What we do know is that he's called the investigation, just like Trump, a witch hunt. So it'll be interesting to see what future that investigation has and what future Mueller has as well.
At this this news conference that we heard a little bit of at the beginning of the programme, Donald Trump did seem to hint that he is considering a bigger shake-up of the top table of the cabinet than just getting rid of Sessions.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. I mean, that's not entirely odd, despite the very hard to keep up with list of ever-changing personnel inside the White House. You know, there are often what often get called to here as resets following midterm elections, because, you know, there is essentially a change in the makeup of power in Washington, D.C. It won't happen until January when Congress changes. But even so, there is a feeling that, you know, changes need to be made based on that. So we don't know yet what other changes will be made. I think, you know, Sessions was the most obvious one that pretty much everyone saw that sort of axe coming down. I'm sure there will be more changes, and we'll have to wait and see on that front what does happen in keeping, I guess, as I said before, with the near constant rotation of personnel that seems to be a hallmark of the Donald Trump presidency.
His reaction to yesterday's results is not massively surprising. I mean, he says, you know, oh, what have I learned from this election? I've learned that people like me and this kind of thing. To be fair to Donald Trump, though, he's done what he needed to do, because people were talking about a blue wave, a blue tsunami, the Democrats wiping out any Republican control. And actually, he's avoided outright disaster.
Definitely. I mean, I was just talking about this today, and I was thinking, really, this isn't a repudiation of Trumpism at all. Yes, the Democrats have, you know, they've won back control of the House of Representatives. That means there is no longer one party rule. That means they can thwart Trump. That means if the two sides can learn to get along, there could even be bipartisan measures. They're talking today about that first bipartisan measure possibly being on infrastructure. But at the same time, it wasn't a tidal wave of blue support. The shift, for example, in the House wasn't as big as 2006 that we saw this year in 2018. The Senate capitulated rather easily, as in Republicans won that. I think it was about 9:30 in the evening Eastern time by the time we already knew that the Republicans had retained control of the House. And, you know, Donald Trump today was talking about, you know, the fact that, look what happened in Florida. Andrew Gillum, the Democratic gubernatorial hopeful, didn't win. The Senate seat there has gone down to wire. I believe it may still be contested, but it's been called for the Republicans, although lawyers may be going down there to fight over that one. So a lot of those emotive, races, including Beto O'Rourke in Texas, even though that was always a long shot, went the Republican ways. And what's interesting, really, is that there are kind of two narratives, depending on which side of the aisle you sit on. I think both sides can spin this as being a victorious day for them. And so it really does depend on your political outlook. But I think, you know, Democrats, as I said before, will be happy for obvious reasons. But it was by no means a complete sort of kick in the teeth for Donald Trump, and a repudiation of some of those comments he has been making about immigration, for example. One final point I want to make is that, you know, the House of Representatives now being Democratic again, there's now going to be a leadership contest for the leader. And Nancy Pelosi is obviously back in there to become House Speaker again. What will be interesting is that Donald Trump actually endorsed her via social media and sort of repeated how much he admired her. He said that, you know, she loves the country just like he does. It's interesting to know why he did that, why he said that. I mean, one theory is the fact that, you know, Nancy Pelosi is an easy sort of villain for the right. Often Republicans, when they're attacking, for example, in their attack ads on television, they often try and soil candidates by linking them with Nancy Pelosi. She kind of stands for all the things that conservatives hate. She is a Californian, liberal. And so in many ways, Trump may be thinking that having Nancy Pelosi around will help him because she's an easy attack person for when the presidential elections roll around in 2020. So that may have been a cunning move on his part, trying to endorse Nancy Pelosi when there are certainly people within the Democratic Party, the sorts of people who voted for those candidates like Ocasio-Cortez, who are more on the left fringes of the party, more in touch with some of that grassroots action, that will be saying, look, Nancy Pelosi's been around for a very long time. We need fresh blood. We need someone new in the House of Representatives. So it may have been a cunning move from Donald Trump.
I read one writer today talking about the governor's race in Georgia, which obviously is one of the really big high profile races that was decided yesterday, who said that if an election that questionable had been staged in another country with all of the sort of underhand ways of excluding voters and people turning up, not being able to vote and all these kind of things, if that had happened in another country, the United States would be questioning its legitimacy. But at the same time, it speaks to something that the Republicans have used the power they have to tilt the table in their favor. But the only way the Democrats can change that is they have to win under that system that a lot of them claim is rigged. Talk about gerrymandering, isn't there? In the House of Representatives, for example, that the districts are drawn up in such a way that it's almost impossible for the Democrats to win in places where they ought to. But fundamentally, you've got to win under that system before you can change it.
But also Georgia was a very particular example. And I don't know if that's changed recently, but Stacey Abrams earlier today was refusing to concede to Brian Kemp because it was pretty vote. We'll have to see if she manages to keep refusing to concede. But I mean, Georgia was very particular because, you know, Brian Kemp, as well as running for governor, was also overseeing the election, which just seems like a bizarre conflict of interests. If you're a Republican, you do feel good about places like Georgia, despite the fact that really that was a very bitter race, as was Florida, with also racial tinges. But the fact is that Democrats did spend a load of money in some of those key places. And I mentioned Florida, that's certainly true. Definitely Georgia as well. They wheeled out the likes of Beyonce in Texas, who got behind Beto O'Rourke. They also had Oprah campaigning in Georgia. So you had these big sort of stars, what Ted Cruz referred to as like Hollywood coming out, and he's kind of very anti-Hollywood. You had lots of money, you had Hollywood behind certain, or certainly celebrity culture behind certain candidates, and it wasn't enough to sway those key votes. So that's certainly something that the Republicans will be holding on to for sure.
Ed Stocker, thank you very much. You're listening to Monocle 24.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back, enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, we're going to stay with the midterms now, because from two Native American women to a Somali refugee to the first openly gay man to be elected as a governor, this year's results are very different from US elections of the past. But what does that tell us about the state of modern America? Well, joining us now is Pema Levy, who's a reporter at Mother Jones in Washington, D.C. There are, as I indicated from that introduction there, an awful lot of firsts hidden away in these election results.
Hi. Yeah, there are a lot of really exciting firsts for us. For example, we now will have not one, but two Muslim American women serving in the U.S. Congress for the first time. That is a very big deal. We'll have more women in Congress than ever, more LGBTQ women, more women of color. I believe, as you mentioned, Native American women. These are all firsts that are incredibly important. And I think they do say something very interesting about the state of the United States and politics here, because they are really a direct rebuke to the vision of America that Donald Trump and his party is putting forward. He's the party of a travel ban that is understood by many as a Muslim ban. He is a party against immigration, demonizing immigration. He is a party who's energized white nationalists. And so, you know, in response to that, you have an election in which Democrats actually made Congress more diverse.
And we mentioned there things like, for example, the man who had been the first openly gay member of Congress is now the first openly gay state governor. But not all the glass ceilings were shattered. The first transgender major party nominee for governor missed out in Vermont. Florida didn't elect its first black governor. The results do suggest the ways in which America is changing and that the attitudes of American voters are changing. But as we were discussing a moment ago in our wider discussion about the results, Donald Trump's supporters still came out. There is still a lot of support for his vision of America. And it seems to show, when you look at the results of this election, that not only are there still two very different Americas, but those differences are maybe even more deeply entrenched now than they were 2 years ago when Trump was elected.
I think that that is probably right. And I think we did see that reflected in results last night. Let's look at, for example, at Georgia and Texas. These are two red states where Democrats launched statewide, you know, long shot campaigns to, you know, turn these red states blue. And unlike in past years, where folks in Georgia and Texas have run as moderates, you know, hoping to win over more Republicans, instead this year, Beto O'Rourke in Texas and Stacey Abrams in Georgia ran as progressives. They ran solidly progressive campaigns, you know, and these are campaigns that not only try to persuade people, you know, who might be undecided, but really aim to turn out the base of the party. And they came closer than Democrats have in those states in a very long time. Really impressive campaigns, even though it appears that they both came up short. So I think that that demonstrates, as you just said, that we're looking toward a future where both sides are going to be turning, you know, basically winning elections by turning out their base, as opposed to, you know, sort of moving to the center and trying to, you know, unite in a way that folks in this country might have thought was the best way going forward just a few years ago.
I suppose in the same way that a lot of Republicans have worried that by energizing the base in the way that Donald Trump does, he dissuades those center ground voters from siding with the Republicans. Is there similarly a concern that if Democrats choose to run from more nakedly progressive standpoints, that again, those center ground voters are harder to reach? And those are the ones that you need to win if you're going to win, for example, in 2020.
I think what this election showed is that we don't know what Democrats need to do to win in 2020. But I think the old playbooks can sort of be thrown out. For a long time, Republicans counted on people in the suburbs, women who were college educated, socially moderate, but, you know, basically fiscally conservative. They were wealthy and they didn't want high taxes, that they would be reliable suburban Republican voters. And what we saw last night was that the, you know, nativist, anti-immigrant thrust, you know, pushing on social issues of the Republican Party right now has pushed those people into the Democratic ranks, even though they might disagree on how high taxes should be, for example. So I think that while Republicans have certainly, you know, riled up their base and demonstrated, you know, Donald Trump has demonstrated a recipe for turning out voters by scaring them about immigration, for example, as one big issue. Those same issues are going to be pushing people who are traditionally Republicans into the Democratic Party. So I don't think it's clear that on economic issues, Democrats are actually going to have to moderate in order to win in 2020. But certainly there's going to be an incredibly robust Democratic primary. Folks who are going to, you know, start declaring their intentions to run very soon. And we're going to see, you know, across the board, you know, a competition of ideas in that Democratic primary. And it's really up in the air what the recipe is now.
Election season, it seems, never ends. Pema Levy, thank you very much for your time this evening. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
Now, no sooner have you adjusted to the latest technological advance, there's always another one racing down the track to make everything you own and everything you know obsolete. But could work on next-generation 5G mobile services be delayed by security fears over some of the biggest firms that want to be involved? Already the United States and Australia have issued warnings about giant Chinese telecoms companies. Now it seems the UK has followed suit. Well, joining me to discuss this is Yun Lawson, who's a senior research fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. Yun, this apparently in a letter sent to telecoms operators in the UK. It names no names of companies, but talks about worries over network security and has been widely interpreted as basically being a warning about dealing with Huawei.
Yes, indeed. I think... And this is almost, you know, Britain playing catch up with others. And it says something, I think, about the different nature of the way the UK is dealing with this, that, you know, the Australians and the Americans have been much more explicit and have specifically identified both Huawei and another Chinese company called ZTE as, you know, in fact, in both cases, not to be used in critical national infrastructure.
So the fear is presumably tied into ideas around data theft and intellectual property and these kind of things.
Yeah, it's more a case there is a fear that the devices, which tend to be things like routers, could have backdoors and vulnerabilities built in, which would allow the Chinese to take control or to interfere with the networks as they wished.
This warning might have come a bit too late, though, for Britain. You mentioned the idea of playing catch-up. One firm's already signed a deal with Huawei to supply 5G equipment. BT, which is the biggest telecoms company in Britain, is using Huawei in a 5G trial in London right now.
Yeah, but as I say, the UK historically in recent years has had a different approach to the others. So there is a centre in Banbury which is manned by people from GCHQ, and they randomly spot check Huawei equipment as it comes into the country. So where other countries have, you know, just placed a blanket ban, the UK has adopted an approach of saying, well, you know, we're not sure about this, but we'll take a kind of middle road of not banning, but equally not just, you know, saying it's all wide open.
It's politically tricky, though, isn't it? Because whatever concerns that the British government and security agencies may have, this is at a time when Britain is desperate for international trade, desperate for inward investment. China's one of the few countries at a time when a lot of people are thinking about shipping out of the UK. China's interested in investing in the UK. And so those officials are walking a bit of a tightrope here.
Well, I think that's absolutely the driver. I think it's all about the economy, stupid, as the saying goes. And it's, you know, for whatever reason, you know, where the US and Australia and others have felt they don't need to be quite so concerned, you know, since the days of George Osborne as the as the Chancellor. The policy has been, well, the trade thing is more important than anything else, and therefore we'll manage this challenge in a slightly different way.
While at the same time warning that Britain needs to be prepared to boost its cyber defences, and we don't have enough people ready to bolster those defences, we don't have enough trained experts.
No, that's an ongoing problem. That's a global problem, though. The shortage of skilled cybersecurity professionals. And you know, there's definitely going to have to be some more creative thinking about how we deal with this. It's all very well talking about, you know, doing more STEM education in schools, and, you know, introducing more funded master's programs at universities. But all of these take 2 to 3 years. We need to start developing this now. So I think there's a real opportunity here for retraining potentially in those cybersecurity skills.
Ewan Lawson from RUSI, thank you very much for joining us. In just a moment on The Daily, we'll find out why a former Labour Party leader in Australia has now embraced the country's hard right. But first, here's a look at some of the day's other top news stories. Lawyers for a Pakistani Christian woman cleared of blasphemy say she's been freed from prison. Crowds have been demanding Asia Bibi's death after the Supreme Court judgment. She'd been on death row for 8 years. Several countries have offered her asylum, but Pakistan's government says it will start legal proceedings to stop her leaving the country. The battle for the Yemeni port city of Hodeida has intensified. Saudi-backed government forces are advancing on Houthi rebel positions. More than 150 people are reported to have been killed since the start of the offensive a week ago. The port's a vital lifeline for millions in Yemen who are at risk of famine. And the mayor of the Polish city of Warsaw has banned a rally that's become a magnet for the far right. Last year, 60,000 people took part. The mayor said that Warsaw had suffered enough from aggressive nationalism. The decision comes days before Poland marks the 100th anniversary of its independence. This is the Monocle Daily. Now, a former leader of Australia's main opposition party is switching sides. He's switching sides to the country's most prominent right-wing, indeed hard-right, movement. Mark Latham looked on course to become Australia's Prime Minister 15 years ago, though instead he led Labour to defeat. Now he's joining the One Nation Party. Here's some of what he had to say explaining that during an interview with Australia's Today programme.
The number one issue in Sydney is overpopulation, overdevelopment, the city becoming unlivable and dysfunctional. And at federal level, people have got a chance to say they can vote One Nation to send a message to cut the immigration rates. We can't go on with 100,000 extra people a year coming into Sydney. And at state level, better planning to make sure we don't have overdevelopment, that we have an end to urban sprawl, rows of apartment towers clogging up our city. That's not the Sydney way, it's not the Australian way. And One Nation in these federal and state elections that are coming up in the next 6 months is a good alternative to the major parties that have lost control of Sydney's growth.
Mark Latham speaking on Australian television. Well, Monocle's correspondent in Sydney is Clarissa Sebag-Montefiore. She's on the line now. Mark Latham is a man who, as we say, nearly became Prime Minister, then from a left-wing party joins the far right. That's quite a big shift.
It's definitely a big shift. As you said, he was defeated in the 2004 election, and then he stood for the Labour Party, which is left, centre-left. So he's gone from the more left-wing party to the far right. Yes,
and he's planning to run for the state government in New South Wales.
He is, exactly, and to do that, he'll be New South Wales branch leader for Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. One Nation is well known here for perhaps you might call it some questionable values around race. And it's very far right politics.
Well, we heard him there on one television interview, and another interview that he gave to the ABC. He said that discrimination of any kind is bad, which suggests that he may not have done a great deal of research about the party he's joined.
Yes, well, Pauline Hanson, she famously wore a burqa to the Senate in 2017 to sort of to make a point. It was really a massive publicity stunt that went down, like a lead balloon. And then more recently, she proposed a motion in the Senate, which was, quote, called "It's OK to be white. she ranted against anti-white racism and said that, you know, she had to, quote, acknowledge the deplorable rise of anti-white racism and attacks on Western civilization, and that it is okay to be white. That got very, very close to going through the Senate, but it also caused absolute outrage in Australia, where racism is still considered a problem here.
Mark Latham has been sacked as a host on Sky News. He's been fired as a newspaper columnist. You could interpret this as a last throw of the dice by a figure who's very much a man of the past.
Yes, it does seem like it's definitely a move that will get him back in the headlines, however briefly that is, and will make a splash, which I'm sure he definitely is aware of. I mean, news.com.au, which is a new site here, said the headline, which I think really sums it up, the question on everyone's lips, how long will the alliance between Mark Latham and Pauline Hanson actually last? So I'm not sure that people think this will necessarily be a long-term alliance.
What it does do, of course, is attract attention for One Nation, get them headlines, get them talked about. There is a general election due in Australia in the next 6 months. There's a widespread assumption that Labor's going to do well in that election. Could this make that task a bit harder for them?
I think so. I mean, it's definitely a boost for right-wing politics. Mark Latham actually told Australia's Channel 9 television that Labour and the Coalition have got the same policies. It's important to give people a third choice. So there's the idea that the centre-left and the centre-right are sort of offering the same thing. So obviously, you know, One Nation has failed recently at the ballot box. It flopped in the 2017 Western Australian state election in Queensland, which is Pauline Hanson's home state, used to be more popular than it is now. And of course, she enjoyed the balance of power in the Australia's upper house and the Senate in 2016. But the party then split with the resignation of several of her members. So One Nation isn't in a very strong position. This might change that. And also, Mark Latham is talking about issues that are important to people, immigration being the centerpiece of that.
The hard right has been resurgent in many countries in recent years. And while One Nation's been a fixture for some time in Australia and Pauline Hanson's been a fixture in Australian politics for some time, is there any reason to believe that if there is a wave of increased support for parties of the hard right in other countries, that Australia would be immune from that?
Well, other countries such as Brazil, as we've seen, and and obviously some of Trump's policies in the States. I don't think anyone is entirely immune to it. I'm not sure. I mean, One Nation is not mainstream by any means at the moment. So it seems unlikely that within this next 6 months, as you said, the national election must be called by May 2019. It's unlikely that there'll be a massive swing to the far right by that point. Australians tend to be quite moderate, you know, politically as a people. So I very much doubt it. That said, as I said before, immigration is a centerpiece of One Nation, and people in the big cities here are very frustrated over what they see as urban congestion, soaring house prices, and it's worth remembering that 70% of the 186,000 migrants who settled here last year all moved to Sydney or Melbourne. So these two cities in particular, some people are feeling frustrated at what they see as a lack of space in what you know, very traditionally roomy suburban culture.
Clarissa, thank you very much. Clarissa Sebag-Montefiore joining us there from Sydney. You're listening to Monocle 24. So a US president launches angry tirades at the press. Russian bots spread misinformation and inflame racial tensions. The rise of online media should have been one of the most democratic innovations in human history. But in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which revealed how more than 50 million Facebook profiles have been accessed without permission to build psychological profiles of voters, it does seem that the dark side of the internet just keeps getting darker. Well, Monocle Reports is a new weekly analysis of the news, available every Wednesday to subscribers to our daily programme, Midori House. And in this extract, Josh Cowles, who's a researcher in the ethics of data at the Alan Turing Institute, explains how the rise of online is changing the nature of politics.
I think that maybe I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Twitter, because I get such a fake press, such a dishonest press. I mean, if you look at, and I'm not including Fox because I think Fox has been fair to me.
Well, we've certainly seen a lot of big stories hit the headlines in the last couple of years, particularly since the major elections, influential elections we had in 2016, both here in the UK and in the US and elsewhere. But of course, the internet has been with us for much longer. And if you zoom out a bit, it's easier to see that this is a gradual but pretty inevitable revolution, I think, in how politicians try to win votes. The first US presidential candidates had websites back in 1996. So there's been plenty of time for folks to get to grips with what's been happening. But I think 2016 was the year in which all this really kind of blew up in ways we didn't expect.
Facebook offered to all of its users a blanket opt-in to share their privacy data with any third-party users.
Congresswoman, yes, that's how our platform works. You have to opt in to sign into any app before you use it.
It certainly has a lot to do with the trove of data we now have about individuals, all of us who use social media. That information, as we know, is essentially for sale, or at any rate, the time we spend on those platforms is for sale. And that has been monetized mostly to sell us barbecues or to sell us bicycles, but sometimes also to try and persuade us who to vote for. But if you look back, as I say, to the early stages of campaigning, the earliest presidential candidates' websites, they looked a lot like what you'd see in the newspaper. So it was just an attempt to replicate the existing technology on the internet. And even that had its advantages. I mean, it scales. You don't have to spend any money to print every additional piece of paper or pamphlet, which is great. But I think what we see today is really a step change in the ability of candidates to target us, not target the electorate in general, hope that enough people come to their side, but to target us specifically.
But when you talk about apology, I think the one that you should really be apologizing for, and the thing that you should be apologizing for, are the 33,000 emails that you deleted and that you acid washed.
Analysis of actually mainstream news media in 2016 suggested that there was more focus on specifically Hillary Clinton's emails than on any other single policy issue, which even 10 years ago would have seemed pretty crazy. And that, as I say, was on mainstream media, but I think that reflects wider trends in society driven more by the internet towards the content, which, as you say, is flashy and attention-grabbing and so on. Basically, if you're advertising on a social network, either you're paying for an ad or you're simply putting a message out to supporters, in order for your message to go viral instead of everything else that happened that some celebrity did that day, you have to compete on the same playing field. And that means competing for really base human emotions, essentially fear, excitement, and so on. And I think that's what's driven the discourse in that direction. I think you need to take every election in isolation. But certainly what we saw in 2016 and what we'll probably see, assuming Trump runs in 2020, is a campaign which is sort of hyper-realistic, hyper-focused on, as I say, kind of attention-grabbing messages because Trump will be involved in that. But what you see from his persona in particular is this attempt to craft short, snappy, memorable messages. And of course, a medium like Twitter is well suited to that. Now, by no means is every American voter on Twitter, but by having a high concentration of journalists on Twitter who are potentially willing to amplify that message onto mainstream media, you can see a chain by which actually Trump only needs to tweet to his 50 million followers, which would not have been enough to even win him the election this time around, but onto the mainstream media agenda more generally. So that ability to capture a particular medium and one which is frequented by other people who spread messages really had an impact in 2016 and could certainly well do in 2020.
We had a case where we had an African-American guy who was a fan of mine. Great fan, great guy. In fact, I want to find out what's going on with him. You know what I'm, look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay.
One way to think about this is if you were living in the UK 20 years ago, maybe ahead of the 97 election when Blair won in a landslide, if you went out to a newsstand, yes, you'd see newspapers being against Labour winning that election, and you'd see newspapers being pro that Labour winning. The problem with the current media environment is that you only see what you're quote-unquote supposed to see. So you only see what either your friends think is most important, and obviously our friends are all skewed in certain directions depending on what we believe in, or increasingly what advertisers or political advertisers in particular think you should see. So it's not so much that we're being targeted with particular messaging, although that is important. The point is that we don't see the whole range of different opinions, and therefore we don't necessarily understand the other side as well because we're not so exposed to those kinds of viewpoints. And I think that's one fundamental difference between the media environment.
If you look at CNN and if you look at these other networks, NBC, I made a fortune for NBC with The Apprentice. I had a top show where they were doing horribly, and I had one of the most successful reality shows of all time. I was on for 14 seasons.
And you see what happened when I'm not on. You saw what happened to the show. It was a disaster. I was on. I was very good to NBC. And they are despicable. They're despicable in their coverage.
Calming words of Donald Trump there, ending the thoughts of Josh Cowles. You can catch the full edition of that new weekly News Digest Monocle Reports by subscribing to Midori House, wherever you get your podcasts. We move on now to this week's tall story from the team behind The Urbanist. And this week we head off to Buenos Aires as Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck tells the story of what was once the highest skyscraper in Latin America, the Caverna Building.
In 1936, the first tenants picked up their keys and marshalled the removal men who were delivering their worldly possessions to the smartest new address in rich and booming Buenos Aires. Not only was their building shiny and new, it stood in an elegant parkside position and had a major claim to fame. It was the tallest building in all of Latin America. The Caverna Building still stands and still turns heads, even if at 120 metres, its lofty ambitions have been rather cut down. And its pull is down to the architects Gregorio Sanchez, Ernesto Lagos, and Luis Maria de la Torre, who designed and shaped its elegant appearance. A slim, 31-storey, modernist-inspired block slotted onto a triangular plot. It's sharp, made from reinforced concrete. It looks like a runaway from the Rockefeller Center in Manhattan. It has that same pacing of windows and a similar stepped form. And there were nice touches for the tenants inside the Caverna Building too. It had state-of-the-art Otis lifts that ensured the building worked like a well-oiled machine. It also had novelties such as air conditioning and roof gardens. Then, and now, the Caverna stood as an emblem of wealth, success, and ambition. And in the many darker economic moments that the city has endured, it must have also stood out as a reminder of very different times, times when fortunes were there to be made. But the building also fused with the city's collective conscience because of a story as delicious as dulce de leche. The edifice takes its name from Corina Caverna, who commissioned the project. She was from a wealthy family made good in Argentina and, according to legend, fell in love with the son of the aristocratic Anchorena's family, who lived on the opposite side of the park. When they put a stop to the relationship, however, it's said that Corina demanded a tower be erected on her plot that would block the Anchorena's family's view of a huge church that they had also stumped up for. Well, it's a good yarn. But what is certain is that Corina was one of the first people to move in and lived on the 14th floor for many years. And even if she lost that man, she won the adoration of generations of architecture fans.
And that's Monocle's editor Andrew Tucker. You can hear the full edition of The Urbanist tomorrow at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, anytime after that at monocle.com. Stay with us. In just a moment, we'll look at some of the top stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Well, let's look now at some of the stories making headlines across Asia. My guest in the studio is Dr. Yu Zhi, who's a research fellow at the Asia-Pacific program at the think tank Chatham House. Let's begin with the midterm elections in the US, because we talked a lot about it at the beginning of the programme. There's been a lot of work in China trying to figure out what the results mean for China, specifically for the trade war.
Well, I think the Chinese leadership have perhaps already prepared the worst is about to come. Because what we're facing this scenario now is even if we have Democrats, which take as a majority for the House, and the overall attitude of the both parties, so this seems to be a bipartisan consensus, this is the opportunity for President Trump to contend China's unstoppable rise. And also, given the fact that the Congress doesn't really have much control over foreign policies, foreign affairs. And for people who are really in charge are Donald Trump himself and the Magnificent Seven boys around him in charge of his trade policy. So at the end of the day, no matter how hard China tried to watch out this midterm election, I think the result was still going to be the same. US-China trade war will continue.
And so, yeah, for all of the speculation, actually, this you say, because the control of foreign policy rests in the White House,
it doesn't
really make any difference.
Exactly. Yeah.
Meanwhile, though, China's vice president turned up at an economic forum in Singapore, and that's been interpreted as a message to Washington.
Well, that's a very significant olive branch offered by the Chinese side. Wang Qishan is a figure most likely very much liked and very popular among Wall Street bankers and also senior policy makers in the previous U.S. administration. And he's counting as currently the number 8th, the most powerful man in China. And his presence in this new economic forum really somehow show how important it is of US-China relations in the years to come. But on the other hand, it also shows some kind of reassurance. Xi Jinping still very much hope the room for negotiation will open between Beijing and Washington, D.C.
So having on the one hand concluded that those elections don't really change anything and that if Donald Trump wants to continue his trade war, that's what's going to happen. At the same time, they are trying to leave the door open to find some
way
to fix it.
You don't put in all the eggs in one basket. You try all different techniques and strategy because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's the economy will be endure or fail, judging by the performance of the Communist Party.
Let's move to Russia now, because reports coming out of there about a series of potential attacks on international football supporters in the country for the World Cup earlier this year.
Well, this is a very surprise one to me. Well, the imagination we had in Russia at the World Cup, and there will be a lot of disruption with hooligans from all over the world and try to disrupt the 30 days long game. But what happened was there's a very few disruptions happened during the period of the games. And for the first time, the Russian spies, FSB, have done something beyond just spying a foreign affairs of another country, but actually doing something protecting its own citizens and tourists of all of the world.
And it's interesting that certainly, I mean, before the World Cup, I know that the police in the UK were warning a lot of the fans who were going to travel and saying, look, don't get yourself into trouble, into confrontation with Russian fans, because the difference between you and the Russian hooligans is the Russian hooligans train in the gym for 6 hours every day and you go to the pub. And so you will come off really badly. These guys get military training. And there was a lot of fear of how this was going to go.
Indeed. But I think
Stakes were so high and the Russians knew that the world was watching them, they were able to rein all of that in.
Well, Russia tried to somehow project its own soft power in here. And to some extent, it has been quite a success.
Let's move on to North Korea now, where there is a portrait of Kim Jong-un's gone on public display for the first time.
Are we surprised? I mean, this is not something should be surprised at all. And obviously, this already demonstrates the young Kim himself has cemented power among his cabinet, and he's no longer that young leader, need his uncle and his auntie to help him to run the country. But nowadays, he makes himself become an international celebrity, become the person the rest of the world really want to see. I mean, think about how many international leaders he met this year. Xi Jinping, Donald Trump, President of Cuba, and Putin is also in the pipeline. So, in a way, it's really a public display. He has a full grip of power.
I'm assuming this is a flattering portrait.
Well, he probably will have to try to slim down at some point because, I mean, just judging by that face, it doesn't look very flattering to me at all. But it's all over the country.
I can't imagine anyone's likely to say could lose a few pounds there, couldn't you, Kim? That seems unlikely. Yuxi, thank you very much for coming in this evening. You're listening to Monocle 24. Finally tonight, even those like me who have only the most cursory understanding of fashion still know that eventually everything comes back into style. And Marc Jacobs, it seems, is taking that lesson to extreme lengths. The designer is reproducing one of his most famous collections 25 years after its debut. Well, let's speak to Dana Thomas, who's a fashion and culture journalist, joining me on the line now from Paris. This is the famous grunge line of the early 90s. Tell me a bit more about it.
It was really a radical moment in fashion. Until then, you know, the most fashion designers were doing jolie madame kind of clothes, if you think about it. I mean, they were fun, but they were always for pretty women. Think what Karl Lagerfeld was doing at Chanel and Valentino and Yves Saint Laurent. They were, you know, comme il faut, very bourgeois looking clothes. And things were sort of, there was always sort of streetwear and some cool stuff coming out of the hip hop world, but nothing, you know, on the runways that was really down and dirty. And Marc put out this collection for spring, summer 1993 for Perry Ellis, which is where he was working at the time as a designer before he had his own line and everything else. And it was sort of capturing the zeitgeist of the music movement that was coming out of Seattle, Nirvana and you know, the Pearl Jam and the whole grunge music movement, which because he was part of that kind of crew. He's an old club kid, but he was hanging out with these cool people. His friend Sofia Coppola was making music videos. He was hanging out with these people and he was young and he was into it. And he decided to channel that onto the runway. And it was kind of like taking the Seattle thrift shop look, but then doing it in luxury fabrics that he did, you know, sort of these flannel shirts, but in silk. And he did, you know, wool beanies, but they were in cashmere. And he did some floral slip dresses, but he wasn't, you know, they were kind of like thrift shop dresses, but, you know, for about 100 times more the money. And stripy T-shirts that were, you know, sort of fashion versions of stripe of T-shirts that you would find at a charity shop. And it landed like a thud among the critics. Bernadine Morris of the New York Times said the typical outfit looks as if it were put up together with the eyes closed in a very dark room. She wrote that in the New York Times. So it really hit, nobody got it, except for the young kids who bought it and were into it. And he was fired from Perry Ellis because of the collection. And then he went on to start his own label and then work at Louis Vuitton. So it really launched him in a way, and he needed to not be at Perry Ellis anymore. And this sort of gave him the moment to step away from that sort of restrictive Seventh Avenue commercial clothing line and really become a fashion designer with a capital F.
But this isn't reworking old ideas. That's a standard in the fashion industry. This is just remaking them. This is re-releasing something. This is like a band re-releasing their greatest hits. And while that might be welcomed by a lot of people, it doesn't imply that it's the product of a lot of work.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, he did it originally for Perry Ellis and now he's re-releasing it under his own label. And so he had to come to an agreement with Perry Ellis to do this. And they're going to help promote the line through their channels. And I suspect he paid them for some of the rights to designs or, you know, fabrics or some, you know, prints and things. But what's interesting is a lot of designers do this. I mean, Balenciaga recently has been putting out reproductions of old and redoing classic designs from Crystal Ball Balenciaga's work, you know, back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And Diane von Furstenberg has all over the years has always included what she calls some, you know, re-editions of her classic dresses from the 70s. And they're really great. And the ones from the 70s are kind of tired and you like, and it's a great dress. Why not, you know, get a new version of it and keep wearing it? But, you know, there's sort of classics in fashion that keep going. And Marc seemed to think that his grunge collection deserved that kind of attention and a second life.
Who's the target market for this? Is it a new generation or is it the same people who bought it last time?
No,
kind of nostalgia
no,
trip.
It's the Brooklyn crew. It's the millennials who were babies when this came out the first time, the ones who wear wool beanies and are into mindfulness and are, you know, gentrifying cool old neighborhoods. And I mean, nothing is more gentrified than the grunge collection, where he's taking thrift shop clothes and doing them in silk.
Now, this all follows reports in some newspapers a few months ago where people were saying, you know, has Marc Jacobs lost his way? And you don't really assure people that you're chock full of new ideas by re-releasing the old ones.
No, I mean, Mark's been having some business troubles, to be sure, since his longtime partner retired. And after he left Louis Vuitton, I mean, he was doing two full-time time jobs at once on opposite sides of the Atlantic for about 15 years. So for, you know, to guess that he might have gotten a bit tired would not be a stretch. And, you know, he's in his 50s now. He's getting married. He's been doing this sort of club kid thing for a long time, and he's a long way from being a club kid anymore. And so I think, you know, when you're in your 50s, it's kind of cool to look back at your 20s and say, what did I do back then? And then he realizes there is a market for it. And, you know, if it worked once, why not? Karl Lagerfeld's been reworking that Chanel suit now for, what, 40 years? And it's a suit that, you know, Coco Chanel designed in the 1950s. So, and they're just riffing on it. And yes, these are line-for-line reproductions of the clothes, but Levi still does the 501 jean, too. Are these Mark's version of the 501s? Maybe.
It's a reasonable comment. Dana Thomas, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Well, that wraps up this Monocle Daily, produced by Ben Ryland and Augustine Macellari. Our researchers, Daphne Carnesis and Gabrielle Delisanti. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Daily back at 2200 in London tomorrow. So that grunge collection was first shown to the public to, as we heard, a mixed critical reaction in 1992, the same year that this Stone Cold classic was first released. So we'll play out with Vanessa Williams. From me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. And goodbye.
Sometimes the snow